This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It should come as no surprise at all that Donald Trump, having lost the 2020 election to Joe Biden, is going to do the transition his way, chaotically, vengefully, and in a state of utter denial. And we all get to come along for the ride. But the president's fantasies about so-called illegal ballots are being indulged by a great number of prominent Republicans. With the possibility of electoral chaos to come, where we go from here remains a hugely open question. I called up Jane Mayer to ask her about some of the reports that are coming out of the White House. Jane's written extensively for The New Yorker about today's GOP and the forces that drive it. Jane, how are you?
Good. Glad to be with you.
So, Jane, as we talk on a Wednesday morning, what's the mood in Washington? Is there a sense that a peaceful transition of power is still possible?
So, 1 week out from the election, I think what we're seeing is a mood of sort of elation among Biden supporters, kind of souring towards a mood of some nervousness that there still has not been a concession from Trump, and a sense that the Republican establishment, not just Trump alone, is now digging in for a fight.
So what is the implications of that? What can that mean at its worst?
Oh, I mean, I think it's incredibly dangerous. That's what we're all, you know, worrying about, is that there's a possibility that somehow this could really disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. So where could this lead? Well, it seems like the law is quite clear. The legal cases so far have gotten nowhere. But the problem is that the politics itself seems like it's getting rougher and nastier. At this point, something like 75% of Republicans are saying that they don't think the election was fair.
And what are the implications of that? What are the practical implications? Because if these lawsuits fail and the law is clear, what is Donald Trump trying to arouse? Support for himself for 2024? Maybe it has implications in Georgia and the Senate race. What is the motivation here?
Well, I mean, when it comes to Trump, I think you've got him, you know, not just running for re-election during this last campaign. He was running from the law. He's going to have to face potential prosecution from the Manhattan District Attorney. He's got something like $300 million in debts that he has to pay off in the next 4 years. He's got a case with the IRS where he may wind up owing $100 million in back taxes. So he's got a lot of his own personal difficulties that make him want to try to hold on to power in any way that he can.
Well, I understand his motivations. And what I don't understand is Mitch McConnell, who is an institutionalist, no matter what you think of his politics, has said that the president has every right to look into allegations. But to be clear, there is zero evidence anywhere for any of these allegations of fraud. So what is Mitch McConnell up to? What does he want?
Well, first of all, I would maybe take issue with the idea that he is an institutionalist. That is how he likes to be seen. But he's actually shattered so many norms during the period that he's been majority leader that I think maybe it's worth reconsidering that
position.
That's
totally fair.
But in this particular case, there's one thing that Mitch McConnell has always cared about more than anything else, almost since he was in high school. He has wanted to be the majority leader of the U.S. Senate. And what he wants to do is hold on to that majority, keep the Republican majority. And as we know, that comes down to one state at this point, two senators, two Senate races in Georgia. So I think the smart way to understand what's going on with Mitch McConnell is he is making a play to try to win Georgia for those two Republican senators, to help them out by riling up the base.
So what is the likelihood they play out this psychodrama until the elections in Georgia and then stand down?
I think at least until then. I can imagine that even after, I assume he will have to leave the White House and move back down probably to Mar-a-Lago, that Trump will keep litigating, keep trying to keep this thing alive and talk, as he has started in the last few days, about running again in 2024.
It was reported that the White House instructed government agencies to block cooperation with the Biden transition team. What are the implications here for the transition, for Joe Biden, and even for national security in the coming months?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of concerns. It's probably lucky that Joe Biden has been in the White House before. He knows his way around. But the concerns are that this is a dangerous period anyway, when a hugely powerful country shifts its whole power apparatus. They need to turn over very important information about national security. They've blocked Biden from being able to have access to the president's daily briefings, which usually are shared after an election. These are the intelligence briefings. There's also concern that because President Trump just fired the Secretary of Defense, and it seems to be putting loyalists in right around him, that that they may be trying to, you know, sort of try some riskier final policies in the final days before the transfer of power.
What does Donald Trump want to sneak in under the wire, if that's the motivation? Are there policies that he wants to get passed? Are there personnel moves that he wants to get accomplished, or is this about reputation and the future of Trumpism?
Well, they're related. One of the things people think he may be trying to do is there's been a push in his camp to get rid of Gina Haspel, the director of the CIA, and there's also a push to get rid of Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI. And why would they want to do that? Because Trump has been frustrated. He wants the FBI and the CIA to put out information that makes it look like he was the target of a witch hunt. He's trying to put out information that supports various conspiracy theories that make him look good.
You know, I don't use this term really, I hope not inadvisedly, but this has the makings, or at least the sketches of, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but some kind of coup d'etat. Is that alarmist?
I hope so. it's not completely out of the question, and that's why it's so worrisome. I mean, the Biden camp seems to be quite confident things will go smoothly. They're moving ahead with the transition. They're expressing very little doubt or worry. And they seem to know what they're doing.
I'm sorry, but this is craziness. This is craziness that the president of the United States, we have to monitor his emotional tantrums and peculiarities, to put it mildly, and the whole country is held hostage to them. It's crazy.
It is, but you got to understand, the reason it's happening is not just because Trump on his own is throwing a tantrum. It's because he has such a connection by now through such an infrastructure of disinformation and right-wing media and everything else that is controlling all of these supporters. And it's the supporters that the Republican leaders are afraid of. I mean, face it, the Republican leadership is thinking about getting reelected instead of thinking about the entire country.
You can read Jane Mayer's article, Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose, and everything else she's written for us at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we're going to put the election aside for a while. You're welcome. And in a moment, we'll be joined by two masters of comedy, Jerry Seinfeld and Steve Martin. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. At the New Yorker Festival last month, Jerry Seinfeld and Steve Martin joined the New Yorker's Susan Morrison, and they talked about the art of creating those little explosive devices that we call jokes.
Now, I know that both of you feel very strongly about the technique and the craft of writing jokes. And I'd love to hear you describe, each of you, the process, your process for coming up with a bit, shaping it, refining it. You know, how long does the whole thing take, and how does it start?
Well, that's an easy question.
That's so easy. I'll let you go first.
The thing I like about writing comedy or any kind of writing is there's no rhyme or reason to it. Nobody knows how to do it. Nobody has figured out anything. So everyone's free to do it. And I kind of like that complete chaos of the process of, especially jokes. I was talking to somebody today, and the guy said, quick question. And I just said, what is a quick question? Why is it any different from any other question? Is it going to be less words? Does it mean my answer is short? It's just one of these annoying little things that people say. So I will write something like that down and see if it annoys other people the way it annoys me by talking about it in front of an audience. And if it does annoy them, I'll just play with it.
I found that performing live, it's just an ongoing exercise with a line. You trim it, you make it longer, you do a different setup, you knock out part of it, and you keep trying it night after night. I think Jerry writes more perfectly than I could. Like, honestly, I feel about Jerry's lines, you go, that's so beautifully cadenced.
And, but a lot of it, Steve, was done by the audience. Those are the final versions. Yep. My original notes bear, you know, not too much resemblance to the final product. I've been reading this history of the Marx Brothers, and they would tour for 5 weeks, four shows a day with a movie script.
Right.
Four shows a day. They'd pick out like six or seven scenes from the movie script and perform them over and over again to find out where the laughs were and to tighten it and shape it. And I've really become obsessed with them reading this book. Steve, did you ever meet any of the Marx Brothers?
I met Groucho. I was at an event. He was very old, very old. And a woman came up to him. I happened to be standing there. And she said, can I shake your hand? And he said, honey, you can shake anything you want.
So it sounds like what begins as a kind of a something loose and lumpy on a yellow legal pad then just gets honed and honed and honed by performing it live.
Absolutely true. I did stand up for 18 years and, you know, honed it and worked it. But I had really honed everything down so much I no longer had any material. I took 4 hours and whittled it down to an hour, and then I just quit.
Right.
But I feel so much more at ease writing comedy now than I ever have in my life. It just seems to come easier. I can quickly write a punchline to something way, way easier than I used to earlier in my life. And I read something, it was in Hungarian, and it was unpronounceable for me, but translated to a relaxed brain. And it talked about people who are witty, they get a relaxed brain and their mind is more relaxed. And I realized I'm more relaxed because I've had a career and I'm not auditioning all the time. And it's enabled me to relax and feel very free.
Where do you think it would have gone? I know how you feel about the transition you made when you finished your stand-up work and moved into the movies. What if you had just not stopped? Because you would have had to transition from this character into someone that was more yourself so that you could be comfortable. And what if you had just kept going? Where do you think it would have led you?
I my mind was so dry. I think it would have been very hard to start up a whole new idea. And the idea of my act was so vivid that it would be very hard to change. But what actually happened is I took 30 years off and came back with Marty Short. And I have a new persona when I'm working with Marty Short, which is kind of a sort of distilled version of what I used to do. But I do have a new persona because of that.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, interesting. Well, so the title of the book, Jerry, is This Anything? And it's about the way comedians routinely, in this honing process that we've talked about, they try out bits on each other and say, is this funny? Is this funny? And, obviously that had to start somewhere in your lives. And I'm curious if either one of you can tell me the first time you met like another funny kid, as a kid, who was the person who you were able to bounce things back and forth with, who you were able to crack up? Because that must be a real moment if you're a funny kid to find somebody who can.
It's actually interesting that you would even ask that, because I don't know, for me, that was a gigantic, gigantic moment in my life when I met another funny kid, which was in third grade. I was so excited because you start laughing together in a way that you don't, before that. Steve, do you remember meeting your first funny friend when you were a little kid?
Sure. Well, but I don't know if we were funny, but we laughed so much and so hard. Now, but I actually don't remember either one of us being funny, but we would, engage in such a way or look around. I wanted to be a magician. And so I was 15 and I got a job at Disneyland's Magic Shop. And there was a guy there, I just saw him last year actually, named Jim Barlow. And he was a funny guy. And he would pitch magic tricks and he had all this patter. And it would just be for customers who had come up in the Fantasyland. And I was dying to do that. And I finally got the job. Somebody quit. And I got the job. I was 15. I couldn't believe it. And I just took, with his permission, I took all of Jim's patter. And eventually, I actually wrote every joke down on a 3x5 card. And there were 200 jokes. And I have it somewhere, all these little jokes. Like Jim would go up to a customer and say, may I take your money? I mean, help you?
So, Jerry, do you know what your first funny friend is doing now?
He's in advertising. I feel like those friends, I mentioned three guys that I went to Queens College with in the introduction of the book who encouraged me. Mm-hmm. And I thought we were all the same. And one day they said to me, you're funnier than us. And we had gone to some comedy club in the city and they told me that they thought I could do that. That was a gigantic encouragement to me that I still remember.
I mean, in the book, Jerry, you say that even today, when you're in the company of other stand-up comedians, you feel like you're rolling around in a litter of puppies. I mean, do you still feel that way? Or are you just kind of home with the kids?
I'm sure, Steve, there is an energy around comedy people that is unlike any other social energy.
I like to be with comedians because I feel an empathy. I feel we've both done the same thing and we understand something.
Right. Steve, do you think that when you have a comedic perspective, you kind of think that the entire human experience is just kind of this silly charade and it's all funny to you? Everything is funny.
I've said this before, but when I was younger, I could be an iconoclast. Mm-hmm. And as I got older, I started to have empathy. And it's uh-huh. hard to tear down people and make fun of people because you kind of feel bad about it. So it's harder for me to be an iconoclast or, you know, a critic now than it used to be, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, I'm more talking about the perception amongst comedians that everything is stupid, every person is an idiot, and everything that everyone does is, you know, deserves to be made fun of.
Yeah, I don't honestly have that.
I think you've grown. I haven't.
I would observe that the kind of comedy that Jerry has always done is more, you know, they call you, what do they call it? Observational comedy. You know that.
Yeah, I've always hated that term, actually. Everything everybody talks about is based on something they've observed. Are there comedians that do things and they talk about things that they have not observed?
I don't describe Jerry as observational. I mean, when I see Jerry's show, and I've seen you live even within the last couple of years, he's a very gentle comedian. And it's just this beautiful rhythm that flows and flows and flows and does all the things that other comedians have to pace the stage and yell and say the fuck and say everything. You know, it accomplishes all those things that other comedians get in different ways.
But Steve, that reminds me to think about your beginnings. During a time when a lot of the comedy was angry and political, you know, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, you were the cheerful, clean cut guy, you know, and your comedy wasn't hostile. It was absurd and funny in a serious time. Were you doing that intentionally?
Yes, but that came as a reaction to the Vietnam War and the, you know, love revolution, that there was so much anger. Every comedian did politics, politics, politics. And I just had this feeling once about 1971. I thought, things are going to change. And I cut my hair and I shaved my beard and I put on a suit rather than my hippie clothes. And I became like an accountant. I think the nation was just kind of ready for something a little goofy.
But the amazing thing about what you did, it was an unbelievable act of self-design that you could see yourself in this other persona. And you even knew this, I don't know how you knew that suit, that the suit would work the way it did. Just everything, it was like a pure invention of yourself. But it was an unbelievable piece of self-design.
So I've heard one of the things that Lorne Michaels likes to say about comedy is that it's polite hostility, which maybe that's a Canadian take, but polite mm-hmm. hostility. Kind of a corollary to that, there's an old line that and the average comedian is three parts funny and one part Ethel Merman. But neither of you seems to me to have that Ethel Merman piece of it. Neither of you seems to have that needy, you know, that needy, angry, hostile thing. How are you so well adjusted and so successful at the same time?
Oh, I think the neediness is really not an ingredient at all. I mean, some people have it, some people don't. But the aggression and the hostility, or maybe a better word might be irritability, is an essential ingredient. If you're not easily irritated, I think it's hard to be funny. There is a certain anger in it that makes us laugh because we all have it, but the comedian gives it a candy shell.
You're right. It, for me, in this sense, is that now when I work with Marty that's where my hostility goes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we get mad at each other in a very slight, subtle way, and we get irritated with each other on stage. You know, backstage, right. We're best friends in the world.
And audiences really, they feel that kind of release. You're kind of releasing that pressure for them.
I once was backstage with Carl Reiner, and now it's 5 minutes before he's going to go on. I said, what are you going to do? Run by some of the jokes. He says, I have no idea. And I said, what do you mean you have no idea? How can you go on with no idea? He says, I just go out and I say what they're thinking.
Wow. Now, Del Close, you know, the improv guru from Second City, apparently said on his deathbed that he was tired of being the funniest guy in the room. So I wonder for you two, is it a burden, you know, being these professionally very funny guys? Do people always expect you to make toasts at weddings? And I mean, can you live a normal life without people expecting you to be cracking them up all the time?
I don't really care about what people expect. I just like to be funny for the fun of it, but I find it difficult when I'm in normal situations to be funny.
It was very hard for me when I first started doing my big act because it was so extreme and people would think I was that. And I couldn't be that anywhere but on stage. So people were, you know, always disappointed. Yeah. I had a hair cutter. A young woman, she's like 25, and she would cut my hair. And she told me once, she didn't really know much about me. And she told me once that people would say, you cut Steve Martin's hair? Is it so funny? And she goes, no.
Well, I'm just going to ask you one more question, and then we'll go. You know, comedians... As you know, I mean, maybe more political comedians than you two, but they tend to look at the news through a special lens. You know, is this news story good for comedy? Obviously, Trump is better for comedy than Obama was. But what about this weird moment that we're in now? I mean, what about the pandemic? I mean, here we are talking about comedy in these little boxes on screens. We have no idea if anybody has been laughing. I assume they have. But what do you two make of what we're all going through right now and how it's, what effect it's going to have on this business?
No, it's not going to affect it at all. I mean, when we can come back, we'll come back and people will make jokes about it. And that'll probably be a huge catharsis, I think, for people to be able to laugh at something being in the past.
I don't do political comedy. I can't stand the idea of saying a joke. We've had this happen in our show. You do a political joke and then somebody goes, yay, and then somebody goes, boo, and then suddenly the audience is not tuning anymore.
No, my friend Jim Downey and also Seth Meyer like to talk. There's this term that they use that I think is great called clapter, which is the audience response when they're not laughing. You know, it's not the combustive kind of involuntary laugh, but it's the kind of a, we approve. Yes, I agree with that sentiment.
Yeah,
and that's,
yes.
I'm sure that's not really what you want as a comedian, right?
Well, it's laugh. Okay, but it's not where the money is.
Jerry Seinfeld's new book is called Is This Anything? And Steve Martin is co-author of A Wealth of Pigeons with New Yorker cartoonist Harry Bliss. They appeared at the New Yorker Festival with editor Susan Morrison. Stick around because in a moment, Yo-Yo Ma appears with Emmanuel Axe to talk about Beethoven and the cello. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We'll get back to that music in a moment because, well, far be it for me to talk over two of the great musicians on the planet. Recently, the cellist Yo-Yo Ma and the pianist Emmanuel Axe sat together on a stage in actual real life to play some of Beethoven's sonatas for the New Yorker Festival. We'll hear an excerpt from their performance, and then they'll talk together with New Yorker music critic Alex Ross, who is listening in from his desk far away in L.A. So, Alex, what did you think?
I'm not here wearing my critic hat.
Do you still like the piece?
More than ever. Thank you so much. That was magnificent to hear, and it's just splendid to see both of you from a distance. My first question was actually, when did you first play a Beethoven cello sonata together, and what is it like now to find your way to a new reading of the piece, having played together so often?
I'd like to start, and then I'd like Manny to continue.
Okay.
Because I've known Manny, we've known each other for over 43 years.
Yeah.
And we probably played this very early on in our... We've been playing this piece for over 40 years.
Over 40 years.
A couple months ago, Manny said, Yo-Yo, did you know that there's this dedication that I never knew about?
This piece, one of the things that completely astounded me was that this is such positive, beautiful, open, hopeful music. And his patron, the one he dedicated the piece to, Beethoven sent him the copy, you know, of the manuscript with an inscription that said, "Amid tears and sorrow."
So we were sort of asking ourselves, what gives?
Yeah.
And we look up the date when he wrote this, which was in 1809.
Yeah, 1808, 1809 and is so the years when he was writing this.
We realize that that's the year that Napoleon invaded Austria, Wagram, right outside of Vienna.
Yeah.
So imagine you're living in this city and this foreign power comes in and takes over your town.
Yeah.
And just realizing the parallel, here's Beethoven who has endured so many tough moments
in his
life.
There's also, right at just that moment, also the personal side. I mean, he's a musician. He's losing his hearing. And between that, what's going on around him in the city, what's going on in the country, there's this music, which is hopeful, beautiful, generous,
noble,
all of those things.
And I thought this is a good piece for this moment because, you know, people are suffering. And we do think that music can give comfort.
Yeah, it does. It has that quality of serenity and contentment and joyfulness, but it's not an oblivious kind of joy.
Quite right. There's in the middle, there's a very tearful spot, but it's just one place. Yeah, I mean, that's terribly, terribly poignant, terribly sad. But again, it's just one episode in this general feeling of hope, at least to me. I mean, these are all personal reactions for us, of course.
Let's get into sort of some of the nuts and bolts of, you know, certain gestures that are just so innately Beethoven that are present in this piece and elsewhere in the cello sonatas. And one thing you mentioned when we were talking before is just this very basic musical gesture, which is sort of the most basic there is. 1-5-1, we call it, tonic, right, dominant, the home key, or
as Yo-Yo said, tension, arrival. You know, and,
right.
And yeah, he makes it incredibly plain, almost monomaniacal, since that we start in this key, and then he stops. What's going to happen next? When are we going to get back home? And he does this 5 or 6 times in the movement. And there are so many examples through Beethoven of this sort of thing.
Give some examples.
The Waldstein Piano Sonata.
Just play.
What's he gonna do next? Fifth Symphony. Same idea. What I love particularly. Sorry?
How does he end the movement?
What you mean, the Fifth Symphony?
Yeah.
He just he finally decides he's going to let you have it with both barrels. So you know, you've ended on the right note. What I particularly love in this sonata is that we finally, the last time we do this, finally, he's going to say, okay, let the cello get. But then the piano says, are you sure? Yes, I'm
very sure. I'm so very sure. Yes, I am very, very.
You know, yeah, we get it.
What Manny's describing is, you know, it's technique. Beethoven uses a certain technique to get to a certain point. We recognize that technique. So by really owning that technique, that gives us the freedom to be able to express and say, we actually know the guy. and I think I grew up, I don't know how you grew up, but I certainly grew up, and I think Manny also, you know, we say, okay, Albert Einstein, he's a genius. There's no way we can approach whatever he does. Beethoven, he's so, you know, certain people seem unapproachable. Yeah. But with Beethoven, I think the more you know, you feel that with actually quite a number of composers, the idea that what used to be not ours becomes ours. Mm-hmm. And it's our music.
But it's also the opposite of familiarity breeds contempt.
Right.
It's this familiarity breeds more and more amazement.
Let's step back and talk about the cello sonatas and what sort of drove Beethoven to take up this form. And he really was inventing a form to some extent. I mean, there weren't examples of these sort of statements in this form with the cello and the piano evenly balanced. And so what do both of you notice about how Beethoven is going about bringing all of his firepower to a form that had sort of much less of a track record than violin sonata, piano sonata, and so on?
Well, in this age of inequality and inequity, I think Beethoven felt that during his time also. the cello was a poor, poor relative to the violin and the piano. And so I think he took pity on the cello and decided that he wanted to, you know, spotlight the cello. So the fourth sonata
also.
And then the piano responds. And the triple concerto, which is very much close to the cello always gets the tune first. It's got to be intentional after a certain amount of time.
I think there's a nobility to the cello sound that he somehow intuited and loved. And you get that in these pieces well. And he was very concerned, we know, in the A major sonata, we're lucky enough to actually have an autograph, a working autograph, where he made changes. And he spent a lot of time not thinking about what the tunes were going to be, but who was going to play them. You know, so he would very often change, the piano would do this. No, I'm going to have the cello do this. And this constant readjustment, and most of it in order to highlight the cello more.
You know, he wrote 10 violin sonatas. He wrote 32 piano sonatas. But he wrote 5 piano cello sonatas. And I think each one is kind of a different invention. And in each case, it's to describe an even more effervescent universe as he got to later stages. The middle one is the one where societal stresses got him to say, no, I'm going to actually do something unbelievably beautiful and comforting. There was so much change that happened during his lifetime. There's so much change that's happening right now. And how do we actually hold on to certain values? And Beethoven certainly was maniacal about holding on to the values he believed in spite of change. And that's something that we think about also.
Right, yeah. This issue of how Beethoven responded to the turmoil of his time mirrors what we are all living through now. And I'm wondering, as you've been playing in recent weeks and months, often in quite unusual circumstances, and I know you've been doing these pandemic, outdoor, distanced events, riding around on a sort of custom-built yo-yo and Manny truck to different places. First of all, what does the music sort of mean to you under those circumstances, and has it changed how you have played it in any kind of palpable way?
I would love to think that what I'm doing with music is helping people in some way. It would certainly help me to play music and to listen to music. I hope that's true for, if not everybody, for some people.
I'd like to say that, you know, one of the things that we were asking ourselves is, well, what is our purpose? Right. And it's obvious that our purpose is not to say we only exist in the four walls of concert halls. That music obviously exists in people's minds. It exists at funerals. It exists at bar mitzvahs, at weddings, at rites of passage, at teenagers. You know, it's like music is something that keeps us going and gives not only gives us comfort, but actually puts us in very specific states of mind, as we were kind of showing a little bit with little bits and pieces of Beethoven. And also, music, it's always individual. The aesthetic experience starts at the personal, individual level. So you don't have to play for 1,000 people. You can play for one person in a hospital room. And in that sense, we find our purpose by knowing how and when we can help. What we did in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, is that Manny had this wonderful friend who's been moving pianos for 30 years, yeah, Stefan. He said, use my flatbed. Yeah. And Blue Q in Pittsfield, this arts company said, fine, we'll build you a stage set, you know? And they came in, and 4 hours, they built this kind of...
And the Yamaha dealer said, sure, we'll give you a little Clavinova to put on this thing.
And the BSO gave us the stairs to go up. So this was a Stone Soup moment where we just all put in something. And the city of Pittsfield said, you know, come... Go to the UPS workers there. You can go to this elementary school. You could go
but
to
you
this.
Know what we discovered also, there's a lot of wonderful people in the world who are doing fabulous things. So for us, it was an amazing thing.
And this also just strengthens like sort of our belief that our circumstances may change, our lives may change, but there's something in music that remains constant. And it offers something, we should always respond to need. This was one of the pieces we played for essential workers
on the truck, and
pop-ups. And we thought that this is, again, part of that same idea of in the midst of great discomfort, you can find certain types of comfort in music.
Wonderful.
Emmanuel Ax on piano and Yo-Yo Ma on the cello. and they were playing Beethoven's Cello Sonata No. 3 in A major. By the way, it's the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth next month. They spoke with Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker, and his recent book is called Wagnerism. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
This episode was produced with special assistance from Catherine Sterling and David Ohana of the New Yorker Festival, and with production help from Kyle Lawrence.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.